the wealthy because you paid even to do your residency. So only the rich could afford to become a doctor. The evidence for it, I was in the first generation of British doctors who came from the working class. One of our teachers, who was a very wealthy man, a friend of mine, had been up all night doing obstetrics, gone to his room in the hospital, fallen asleep without getting undressed, and then his pager went and it was a ward sister. Mr. Charles is on the ward waiting for you. And he rushed down, and when he got there, Mr. Charles looked at him and said, "Driscoll, get your man to press your trousers." Two earls, eh? So all my family in the previous generation were smart. They got as far as you could in the working class, the top of which was to be a toolmaker. They have, of course, been totally abused by the global elite. One of the reasons I was pleased to see, the main reason I was pleased to see Trump arrive is that blue-collar people have been shafted by the elite since 1950 at least. And for the first time, they reacted. And I said, good for you. It's time. You can't be any worse off. The elite have a house in every bailiwick, so if it goes bankrupt in one, they just move to another. The gap is bigger than it's ever been. So that would annoy some of you, but you can come and get at me afterwards. I'll enjoy the argument. Argument is part of my life and part of the world in which I grew up. My grandfather was a Rolls-Royce-trained toolmaker and also a Marxist and a trade union leader. I thought Churchill's Christian name was Brimston, because he always called him Brimston Churchill. And the first thing I knew about him, about Churchill, for certain, was that he had sent, when he was Home Secretary way back, he had sent the troops into Ebbw Vale, a mining area of Wales, to close down a strike which was totally legitimate. It's totally legitimate to strike when you're not being paid a living wage and when the owners could afford to pay a living wage. And Churchill closed it down. I think he admitted once that he was wrong. They danced in the streets of Ebbw Vale when he died, because he was not open with his repentance, which is what we all need to be. So that's the kind of background I come from. And the affirmative action in my life occurred for high school. The city of Birmingham is a very working class area, where the Industrial Revolution started, basically. And the local council's usually socialist. But Birmingham has one of the six best schools in England intellectually, a school that Tolkien went to a generation before I did. They are an interesting concept, a bit like your, what do you call those schools that are?
Charter.
A bit like your charter schools. You could learn some things from them. But they're run by a board, and they're independent, and they do an incredibly good job. And the council was aware they did, and gave them money, over which they had no power when they gave it to them. But they said, we would like you to have two working class boys in the 100 boys a year that you take. That's affirmative action of a sort. And they suggested that they take, everybody had to do an 11 plus exam. So the ones who got in were at the top of that exam. And this is population base of 6 million. I had no idea what's happening, except that I arrived at high school and my homeroom master spoke 5 languages. So I thought, so this is high school. It was. Going to university afterwards was boring by comparison. Almost everybody in my final year at high school became a professor in the class, at least the ones I know. So there's at least half a dozen professors in that group. You didn't know. They once had 2 future archbishops of Canterbury in the class at the same time in Classical 6. And, of course, what we do now, by the way we've changed our entry into university, is we make the really bright students totally bored. They get into drugs and alcohol, and they're lost. We ought to run, at least in the first year, foundation courses, of which our model at Augustine would be a very good one, and send them into second year, if not third. Then they won't be bored. For a university to destroy somebody's life by making them bored, that must be the ultimate contradiction. So some of my responses you can lay at the feet of that history. Now, then I went off to university from a very Bible-based home. I never went to school ever without the Bible being read to me before I left. And it would be read in the evening as well. I never achieved anything close to that with my children. The last thing my mother said to me as I went out of the door was a quote from St. Paul, "Beware of philosophers." Beware. Philosophers, Colossians. Of course, the first thing I did was take a philosophy course and realize that she didn't need to worry. They were majoring in the minor at every direction. But I also did, by the grace of God, get taken to church on my first Sunday in London by another student, and it was Martin Lloyd-Jones. So I was in Martin Lloyd-Jones's congregation frequently during the first 5 years in London. I met Sally in my second year, her first year, because I shared a room with a guy from her hometown. And I was smitten. I don't think she was, but the first thing we did together was go to the opera and go to Martin Lloyd-Jones, or if we were bored, John Stott. Not for very long. We're both always right. We still are. which leads to a few sparks. But they're usually creative. Relationships didn't last very long. A few weeks, and we'd go off in our separate directions. But after 7 years, she decided she'd like an argument for the rest of her life. And certainly it has not been boring. I was made to be an academic, and I would have spent my life in the library if it hadn't been for her. She shouldn't have married me when she did, but that was also providential. The guy who married us was a very wise man. When I went to the wedding service, I didn't know there was going to be a sermon. And it was directed, as far as I was concerned, entirely at me. I've never been to a wedding where somebody read, "No man setting out to build a tower first doesn't find out whether he's got enough bricks." But that was basically the text for our wedding. And he was looking at me saying, "I don't think you've got enough bricks for this project." and he was right. And that took us back to church. And we were blessed, very blessed, to have a small group of very much more mature people, including, it wasn't an ageist group, there were old people in the group as well as young. I hate these things that divide up by age. We need to break them down much more. And that kept us sane, and I think got us through the first bit of our marriage. We weren't going to have children. She was going to be, you know, some world-famous UN person or something like that. And I was going to be an academic doctor. But we were careless, and shortly we had three children. The fourth one didn't happen till Jamaica. Yeah. But it was 2, 3, 2, 4, 6, 8, and I'm not pregnant, right? Nor Catholic. Yeah. So when the children came along, I was doing internal medicine. I'm made for exams. I don't fail them. So in Britain, if you can pass the exam, they don't care whether you had been to the lectures. Which I think is the right way to go about it. One of my best friends good friends, we came in touch with again just a couple of years ago after 30 years. And he's a good example of this. His wife was a good friend of Sally's. They ran a playgroup at the church. And I met Chris that way. We're both fascinated by the physiology of the kidney. When he came to do his clinical work in London after the first 18 months, which you do elsewhere, he went to lectures for 1 week, and then he said that these are a waste of time, and he never went to another lecture in medical school ever. He instead wrote papers that were published in the Journal of Physiology. He said, "I can learn, as I did too, I can learn enough for orthopedics from the book in 20 minutes. I've never set a fracture in my life, never been to an orthopedic clinic, never been on an orthopedic ward round. I wasn't going to do that, so why would I need to bother?" You just had to pass the exam. And the Brits allowed that because if you've got talent, they want to let you go. And when we went to university, only 5% of the population went to university. So the class is had a totally different character to what you have. You don't get to this till you're doing the master's level now. And by then, their brains have been got at and are addled in various ways. It's hard to deal with. So with that background, I passed the exams that were needed. And you could take the equivalent of boards whenever you wished after you got your MD. And I took it for a bet 18 months after my MD, and I won the bet. But then I'd got nothing to do because in Britain, it's where Tolkien got the idea of the tweens from, they never give you a responsible position till you're 30. So I had years to fill in. So I went around multiple specialties. And that's what I was doing when our children arrived. And then Sally said, I need you home a bit more. Can't you do something different? So I said, well, I'm a bit bored. I'll do a PhD. So I did a PhD in order to see my children in cell physiology. And it worked incredibly well. When it was over, Sally, with the usual question that's not a question, said, you're not going back to internal medicine, are you? You promised me we'd travel, find something useful to do from your PhD in a nice place. And we ended up in Jamaica studying severely malnourished children with a Wellcome Trust paying all the bills for the next 7 years. I mean, this is paradise. It was lovely for us too. And then that came to an end, and I was supposed to go back to a job already ready in London, but Mrs. Thatcher cancelled the funding, and we came to Ottawa, which was perfect for us. It's a wonderful place to bring up children. We just hope that most people don't know it exists. It's 25 years behind the time, but it has a world-class orchestra and all those kinds of things. It's the capital city. But girls can come home from university at night at 9 o'clock without any fear. That's not going to last much longer, but it lasted for the whole of our time. Now, I was an invisible Christian still at this stage, and students brought me out of my ivory tower. I believe the story was true, always did. I don't have a conversion story in the evangelical sense. I have a coming awake story. I knew the story was true. I accepted that Jesus was the Son of God and he died for my sins, and I was glad about that. But Paul is much more concerned with present continuous salvation. How have you been saved in the last week? Every week should have some example of God moving you on, present continuous salvation. And it was unbelieving students who did it to me. Because I had to teach biochemistry to medical students as part of the deal. Well, it wasn't. I was just told I had to. Now, if you want a totally futile activity, it's teaching biochemistry to medical students. None of you can remember any of it except perhaps the Krebs cycle, which you'll probably get wrong, but you know it's there. None of you have ever seen a patient without a Krebs cycle. It has no relevance whatsoever to the practice of medicine. It's nice to know that it's there, but you don't make any use of it. And I was cynical. I said to the students, I've got to teach you this for the next 6 weeks. Go and look at the questions from previous years. If you can answer those, you'll be fine. If you don't want to come, I don't care. They did come, but they came for the throwaway lines like the opening. They hadn't had an opening like that. And then I made a comment to them, I can't fill in the background to it, that if Alan Bloom was right, they were ignorant. Because Bloom in 1987, in the Closing of the American Mind, said the modern American student is best described as an empty slate. That's the title of the first chapter of that book. And the basic thesis that he has is that great cultures have a great book. And when the culture loses the great book, the culture will die. He was prescient, wasn't he? If you've got you can get a copy in any second-hand bookshop for $10 or less, a buck probably. Tear it all out except the first chapter if you're looking for space. But if you're not going to do anything else, read the last two pages of the first chapter. They're brilliant because they're written by a predatory homosexual Jewish atheist who sees the truth. So some students came and complained that I'd called them ignorant, and I said, well, it's not me, it's Bloom, and he's not here to give you an apology, so let's instead do the test. And they said, what do you mean? And those of you who haven't heard me talk before, hopefully those of you who have can pass the test now, but I won't ask, it'd be too depressing. But I said, you all love Gandhi, and he thought the Sermon on the Mount was the greatest piece of literature ever written. Tell me how it starts and what it says. It's highly unlikely that you can tell me. And they couldn't. And I said, there you are, he's right. And they said, what are you going to do about it? I said, precisely nothing, it's your problem, not mine. And then they said, you claim to know something we don't, so why don't you teach us? And my mother turned off the back of my head at that time and said, you should. I knew I could. I said, all right, you don't even know the questions, let alone the answers. So what you need is an Agnostics Anonymous to get your questions right. And so AA was born on the spot. And it was an extracurricular course, and I got 25% of the class every year that I did it. And the only prerequisite for that course was that you couldn't claim to be a Christian. So I got the non-Christians. Christians would creep in, you know, after we got going. But it was good for me. Probably better for me than for them, although I do occasionally meet people who remember that course. But as I walked away, I realized I couldn't pass my own test, which you can't pass either. Because as a professor, you should never volunteer, you should never try to be a professor, you should be asked to be a professor. That's the only safe way to do it. Because if you're meant to do it, you do it easily. Lectures are not a problem. Press a button, there's 25 or 30 lectures you could have without requiring a note. That's what real professors do. If they can't do that, they should be called something else. It's a funny quirk, but God makes people who can remember 60 piano concertos. It's the same sort of phenomenon. It's a gift. You can't be proud of it. You have to live with it. And then I realized, as a Christian, I couldn't give an account of our Lord's Sermon on the Mount, his longest piece of writing. So I learned it by heart. And it has transformed my life, without any question. The most important thing I ever did in my life, other than actually become a Christian in the first place, which I don't remember. I could change this lecture now and spend, if I really did it, the next 3 hours taking you through the Sermon on the Mount, and I would not require a note, because it's that close to me. I can honestly say that it's very rarely that there's a period of 24 hours in which it doesn't appear in my mind, which is astonishing and wonderful. It's the most coherent sermon ever given, once you realize it's not the sermon. It's the lecture notes on the sermon. Your job is to compare scripture with scripture till you realize what Jesus said to connect those amazing aphorisms. And it's all the way through the New Testament. The Book of James is a commentary. Ultimately, that led to the college, Augustine College, where we have been teaching the history of ideas to largely, not entirely, but largely Christian students, because six of us were brought together and we'd all watch the phenomenon that your children and your grandchildren, when they go off to university, have less than a 20% probability that when they come out the other end, they will be active Christians. The university is deadly to faith, particularly if you do the physics envy programs, psychology, sociology, anthropology, social work, that lot. You shouldn't go near them until you've been prepared for them much more extensively. So we started teaching a history of ideas program in which it's really a cultural history is a better idea, with an emphasis on the people and the ideas that made the difference. Premised on the premise that you are the product of Hebrew and Greek thought modified by the church, which is true. The secularization that occurred, and I'm going to talk about a bit in a moment because it's essential background to what we're talking about, is basically tacit atheism. And it couldn't have happened except by being a Christian heresy. Secularism is essentially Christian heresy, and it's breaking down, as you can see, very clearly. So that's where I'm at. Do you want to say anything, or do you want to wait to the end and say that everything I said should not be listened to? Yeah, but we're on holiday. It doesn't matter. They can go out when they wish. Nobody cares. Well, I'll tell you one thing about her, and one I'm going to tell because you won't. One of the things we did in the late 80s, we went to Africa because my interest in malnutrition took us there. Sally became an Africophile immediately. Very shortly, she was usefully abusing my character to say she needed to go at least a month before me to set up and at least 2 months after me to clear up. So she got 3 extra months a year in Africa and I got 2. Then in 1994, the Rwanda war blew up. That was the year our last child went to university. And 7-year-olds were trying to care for 4-year-olds in the streets of Goma and Bukavu. I knew Sally would not come back, and she didn't for a couple of years. And the UN gave her, how many refugee camps was it? 4?
3.
3? No.
3.
Okay, I'll believe you on that. It felt like more to me. Which she ran very efficiently and very effectively. Probably one of the most moving moments in my life, which I'll tell you at some risk that I might cry. I went out to see her in the summer of 95, and I ended up teaching, because of her, teaching in the refugee camps for most of the summer. Anything up to 6 hours a day, as much as 5 times a week. I wasn't tired. I felt his pleasure, just like Eric Liddell felt his pleasure when he ran. God gave me the ability to express easily and well. And that summer was the first time I gave the gift back to the giver. And I felt his pleasure. It is absolutely intoxicating. The end of the summer, as usual, she had a brilliant ending. And she said, there are lots of pastors in the camps. And they have nobody caring for them particularly except her. And in particular, they need to have you for a weekend. I can bully the UN to allow me to open a mission station in Bukavu. All the missionaries left. They couldn't handle the chaos. And you can teach them for a weekend. And we can let them sleep in a bed and give them some decent food. And so we did. I got to the end of the weekend, and a Rwandan pastor who spoke good English thanked me beautifully. And then he turned to Sally and he said, and your wife is the most honored lady in all these camps. I'll never forget that moment. Now she won't be capable of saying anything, but so I'll carry on till later. But because it's even more deeply moving for her, the whole experience. When you're talking to her, don't gush, that's all, if you know what I mean. That's the hardest thing to take. When you've done something as extraordinary as that, people want to say how extraordinary it is. Don't do that. Just forget about it. Now, the topics for this week and the CME credits you're going to get were a bit of a surprise to me about 2 months ago. Alan and Aaron and Sally knew what I was supposed to be talking about. I assumed that they would be asking me to talk about what I know how to talk about. But they decided that these are the issues of the day that should be dealt with, and I do talk about them to a degree. But a couple of months ago, Sally said, you need to look at what you're talking about at Deer Valley. And I said, when I looked, I said, well, that's going to be interesting. The first thing I have to say about all these issues, I mean, sex, sexuality, marriage, and all that goes with it, is where we're in deepest trouble, isn't it? There's no question about that. But if you engage that discussion at the medical level with the protocols that are being dropped on you by the global elite in one form or another, you've lost the battle. Any general who fights a battle on ground chosen by the enemy will lose. So you mustn't fight on those grounds. And what I hope to do this week is to give you some means to engage without them winning, but with you winning. We're going to lose some in this one before we win the war, which we will in the end, God willing, or Christ will return. And we may win without America or Canada. God has no particular love for countries, but he loves people. And he always has and always will. the books that I would put down, and I see most of you got pens, so you know this is coming. So the beginning of this, the books that have mattered most in putting this next little bit together is Barzun, An Age of Decadence. That's about this thick, but it's actually very readable. And it is, he's a professor at the University of Chicago, and the Age of Decadence is now. And he was aware that the Enlightenment is better described as an endarkenment. Alistair MacIntyre was the first person to call it that. I certainly call it that because it's what it was. And it had nothing to do with the scientific revolution. The Enlightenment and the scientific revolution are quite different and have different roots. And of course, the liberal elite who rule us have no idea. Well, let's just take a quick check. Which century would you choose for the birth of the modern scientific world? If you haven't heard me talk about this before. 18th? Well, it's at the very latest, the late 13th century. That's why the Renaissance was parasitic on what had happened between 1277 and whatever date you want to use for the start. When I'm in a particularly cynical mood, I say the Renaissance is about nudity and art. Yeah. And now, that's a little unkind, but you know what I'm saying. They were proud of rediscovering Greek learning, and what the scientific revolution needed to do was to get rid of some Greek learning that needed to go, but they also got rid of some that we needed to keep, and that also will come out. So Barzun does a lovely, I mean, it's a huge period of time to cover with so much happening, but he does it well. More interestingly, and certainly to read before you read Barzun, would be Mangal Wadi's book on the Bible, the book that changed our world. Yeah. How many of you were at the CMDA meeting where he spoke a couple of years ago in the Carolinas? None of you. Okay, so it makes it even more worthwhile. I'll come back to him in a moment because my first point is drawn from him directly. The book that changed your world, and that book is the Bible. And the name is spelt phonetically Mangal Wadi. I didn't bring my copy with me. I should have done, probably. The next book on the list is Gertrude Himmelfarb's book, The Demoralization of America. That was published some years ago now, but she saw what was coming. She's a professor, Gertrude Himmelfarb, at Harvard. I think she's Jewish, but I don't know that. Her husband is certainly part of the neocons. Brilliant scholar, English prof, with a major interest in the Victorian period. And the point that got to me was when she pointed out that in both America and Britain, at the end of what would be called the Victorian period, the end of the 19th century, the illegitimacy rate was in single digits as a percentage. Now in America, 75% of black boys in America do not know who their father is for certain, and their mother is not highly reliable either when we do DNA. Now, the two curves for this fall-off are parallel, but the black community began to lose marriage in the 1920s, and we left it following the Second World War. I understand what happened after the Second World War. I have yet to find a black scholar who can tell me what happened. How did it happen? I mean, sure, there are some awful things like paying black women not to have husbands around so they could get welfare. That is disgraceful. That was Johnson. Awful. But it happened. It started before that, and I don't know why. If you ever find out, please send me an email. I'm fascinated by the topic, and I have not seen. Even Saul, as far as I can see, has not really been able to get his hands on quite why it happened. Our dominantly white community here, we fell apart following the Second World War. Well, war separates husbands and wives, and husbands are unfaithful during the war, and that breaks up marriages. And the other thing, of course, is the pill. The pill, has been utterly disastrous for marriage. And of course, evangelicals, Protestants were the ones who were not smart enough to see what was going on. We said it's okay within marriage, as though you could have it on the market and keep it within marriage. I mean, that's a rationalization that can only be called stupid. And the result has been, of course, exactly what you see. And it's not an accident that divorce plateaued where the use of the pill plateaued. But I'm going to have more to say about this later on, because it's very important. The next one on the list is, of course, McIntyre, After Virtue, a book written in the late 70s by, I think most people would say, arguably the most important philosopher alive today. Certainly up there in the top few. And he began as a Marxist. Like many people, you pay for the life you've had earlier. He's had three wives. He then gradually realized that Marxism does not work, will not work, and why. And After Virtue was the book that propelled him not just into the high levels of academic philosophy, but into political thought in general. Anybody who reads and thinks knows that they have ultimately to deal with McIntyre. Now, it's easy to give you a little picture of what it's about, and then you can go and do a lot of work afterwards. It's likely it will take you, if you read it carefully, it'll take you a year to read it in the first instance, and you'll need to read it again to start getting it together. But you will never regret doing that. But the opening and the end you can relate to very quickly. The opening is a parable. He says, I want you to imagine a know-nothing government taking charge. Now, both Republicans and Democrats would claim to have had experience of that. We've certainly had it in Canada. We've had it throughout the Western world. And they decide that all the problems in the world are due to science and scientists. This may well happen with the Greens taking over, who are anti-science when it comes to any real science in many cases. Not all of them, but many of them. And so they decide that the way to put the world to rights is to blow up the laboratories, lynch the scientists, and burn the libraries, and then we'll have a grand new growth of a wonderful society. And of course, it doesn't work. And they have to poke around in the ruins to try and reinvent science, having got rid of the people who really knew what it was. Can't be done. Then McIntyre says, what I'm asking you to understand in this book is that that is exactly where we are now. This is late 80s. But not in relation to science, but in relation to morality. And he was right. And we're going to be talking about it all week in one form or another. He then does a very idiosyncratic review of Western philosophical history, a brilliant one. But he assumes you know far more than most people do, so you're going to put the book down and then have to go and read another book before you can read another paragraph sometimes. You know, that's the way it is. But slowly, you will get there if you work at it. But the end of the book, you can follow immediately. The peroration at the end is so good, I can paraphrase it. He says, if you have followed my argument, you will see that I am proposing that we have already entered upon a second Dark Ages. But we should not be without hope. The last time this happened, good men and women withdrew from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium into the task of keeping the civilities and the virtues alive, and they succeeded. The only difference is, last time, the barbarians were waiting at the gate. This time, they have been ruling us for quite some time. And it is our failure to recognize that fact that is at the heart of our problem. We are waiting for a doubtless new St. Benedict. Because what preserved the West was the monasteries and the Benedictine rule of 8 hours work, 8 hours worship, and 8 hours sleep, basically. That's where learning was preserved. It was a very, very close-run thing. literally down to probably one man in Europe who was capable of reading the Greeks in the original around the 7th century. I forget the dates of Boethius. It did, in fact, disappear. There was no one who could do it. Fortunately, by the grace of God, the Christian church had split between East and West. Greek learning came back to us not through Europe, but through North Africa and Spain. The Muslims honored Aristotle, especially, and the Greek scientists, mathematicians, they were largely. And they preserved that learning. They added something to the mathematics and astronomy. They never did an experiment. One tried, and he had to feign madness to survive, but that's another story. And then around the 10th, 11th century, when Europe had begun to settle down in various ways, and the Muslims were pushed back after the Battle of Tours, in which the Dark Ages that were not so dark showed how much more powerful they were than the Muslims. I mean, what won that critical battle was the saddle with a pommel and a, I don't know what you call the front, anyway, front and the back to the paddle, the saddle, large horses, stirrups, which made it possible to use a lance for the first time. And also the discipline of the army that would keep formation, in this case for a day, with pikes. And if somebody was killed, the guy behind moved into their place. But there weren't that many deaths when you've got a square well formed with long pikes and shields. So the Muslims on their wonderful horses and their super swords and even their arrows, all day, every time they came a bit too close, they'd get a horse with a pike, and there was steady erosion of the Muslim forces and very few losses in the European ones. And at the end of the day, the first charge of Western cavalry happened, and the Muslims were back over the Pyrenees, and they never came back again. It was going to be a few centuries before they were pushed out of Spain. The last time they challenged Europe, which century was that? Not as long ago as you think, the 18th, the Second Battle of Vienna. Most of the liberals have no idea that the Muslims still had the desire to rule Europe by force just over 350 years ago. And they're taught that. It's not that this isn't known. I mean, like all academics, I thought the Bush was stupid because that's what I was brainwashed too, couldn't be bothered to do the work. But then, very quickly, in three areas that I knew a little bit about, I was astonished at how good he was at finding the best. Within a week of 9/11, he was talking to the best non-Muslim scholar on the Muslim world, who loved the Muslim world. And the book is still worth reading, What Went Wrong, by Bernard Lewis. Only the stick. Bush got to him in a week. When he set up his faith-based initiatives, he found somebody he had no right to find. But he did. I mean, the Beltway did this guy in, but he was the right choice. He was right, A, to realize the only people as a group who can change black culture in this particular area are the pastors. But the pastors themselves need help. Good men. Not sufficiently taught. And the guy he found to head up that program, I've got name block for him for a moment, but he will come back in just a moment. He was the son of an inner city policeman in Philadelphia. Very, very smart. Went off to Princeton on a scholarship to do criminology. Was bored by the undergraduate program because he was too smart, so he crept into the PhD without anyone knowing. They didn't find out till Christmas when they called him in and said, you can't do your PhD concurrently with your undergraduate degree. And he said, I came top in both courses. And he won the argument. So he did them concurrently. I wish his name would come back, but... What? No, that was the next one. It will come back sometime during the next hour. If you're still here, you'll find out. The third one was Bush's ethics committee, which he set up with the Senate and Congress as the target for the ethics that he wanted. more. He didn't understand what he was asking for, but he wanted the ethical discussion to be raised, and he chose a Jew, Leon Kass, who's a philosopher biochemist from the University of Chicago. And the people that Kass appointed were smart. I knew them by having had a conversation with half of them, and you listen, you don't talk. They were very smart. The only way they could deal with the politicians could deal with them was not go near them, which is what they did. They did publish some good stuff, which I didn't get copies of, but if you ever see any stuff published by Bush's Ethics Committee under the chairmanship of Leon Kass, buy it. It will be worth reading. And if you want to get a sense of how good Kass is, how many of you have come across Kass as a commentator on Genesis? Just Aaron. I probably take responsibility for that, yeah. Brilliant book. Would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think I have read a commentary that engaged me quite like that one did ever before. But of course the Jews have spent a lot longer thinking about things than we have. And just to illustrate, he begins in the first chapter or so by saying, it's interesting that two things in the creation story do not get the accolade that they are good in and of themselves. The whole of creation does. But two things don't get an individual accolade. I'll leave you to stew on that. I miss that too. But it's there in Genesis 1. The Jews had been thinking about it, had some very interesting comments. And again, the reason I bring him up now is he's not irrelevant to today's projects. He and his wife actually taught a course on courtship in the University of Chicago. And if you didn't sign up on day one, it would be full. And they produced a book of readings called On Two Wings. If you want a book of readings on marriage of very high standard, that's where to go. The final name on the list, we might get started with this lecture at some stage, is Charles Taylor, The Secular Age. Particularly as evangelicals, we have to recognize God used the Catholics to keep the faith alive for 1,500 years. Something was happening that God wanted to happen. Charles Taylor helps you to understand that. And he also helps you to understand why you feel uncomfortable with Catholics who can't say they've done anything wrong. He's a Catholic, but he lays out all the things they got wrong. And interestingly, Reno does it in this month's First Things as well. Worth reading his piece for that. The Catholic Church is in disarray. We will not be in a better state if it disappears entirely, which it could. Certainly I expect some dioceses to go bankrupt in America over what's been. We should be welcoming them with open arms when they come, with a fairly modest requirement that they believe the Apostles' Creed is true for entry. That would do fine. We've got things to learn from them as well. Charles Taylor helps you to understand that very well. It's a very good book. So now to this question, enlightenment or endarkenment, and how important is it to all these sexual and other questions that we have going on? Well, the answer is exceedingly important that you understand it. Some people understand it very well, which is where Mangal Wadi's book comes in. He was a Hindu. From a good Hindu family, but liked learning, and went to university, and realized that it was the university as conceived by the British Raj as what he really wanted. Because knowledge to a Hindu at the end of the day is of no great importance. That got him because he could see it was. And he became a Christian over thinking about these things and then moved with his wife to live near the farm that they and his father had had, but with the poor, to live the Christian life in a totally corrupt area where the police and everybody else were in cahoots to basically rob the peasants. His life's been threatened many times. He gives you some descriptions of some pretty frightening experiences. But he realized that the British had brought to India something which is very rare and which the current students in university are all on about colonialism without any idea of what it means, what they're talking about. Certainly no specific accounts. Because, of course, Britain didn't colonise India. The East India Company founded ports around the edge in order to trade. They got their empire by accident because they wouldn't tolerate the things that the East India Company was doing that they didn't like, and so they sent legislators to change it. And as Mangalwadi documents in considerable detail, because you have to, it was the products of the 18th and 19th century evangelical revivals that went to India with the British colonial service with evangelization in mind. And the British Parliament was persuaded right early on when they were taking over from the East India Company, said, this is too far away from England. It's only because it's socially in chaos and trade is something we are interested in. But they will eventually have freedom, and we should start to ask ourselves the question, what is going to be necessary for them to rule themselves in a way in which they can join the world trade system? That was their intent. There were no roads, so they built them. There were no railways, so they built them. There were no universities, so they built them. And yes, they were the product of their age. And I guess the women in this room at least would be pleased with one bit of totally politically incorrect behaviour when Hindu leaders went and said that burning a widow with her husband is our culture. And the Governor General of India said, it is our culture to hang people who do that. Yeah. And it stopped. You won't hear that talked about by a social justice warrior. But it's a pretty good example, isn't it? So Mangalwadi was an honest guy. He loved learning. Anyway, the little anecdote that I wanted to start with, because we are talking about the way our society is changing, and you're all old enough to see it, and some of you, like me, who are getting on, know even more of it. But as he was working out his faith, people got to know him, and he was going to Europe to meet some people who were interested in his work. And he got on the plane, he was tired, but he said, the Sikh gentleman next to me insisted on talking to me. And eventually he discovered that he was living in the poorest parts of India, on a farm, living like the local people, and the Sikh guy said, you should leave that and go to England. Easy to make money in England. And Mangalwadi said, why? He said, they trust you. Mangalwadi didn't think too much about it. He went to sleep. But when he got to Europe, he came back to him when he was staying in Holland with a Christian man there, and he went to his house and he looked in the fridge. Oh, he said, we need some milk. We'll go get some. He picked up a jug. It's just across the road, he said, and they walked across the road to the farm, into the dairy. There was no one there, so he drew some milk off from the tank, reached up top of the shelf where he knew there was a basket, brought it down, put in a note, took out the change, walked out. And Mangalwadi was absolutely stunned. And he said, in our country, if you tried that, they'd take the milk and the money. How did that happen? And the guy didn't know enough history to fill it out completely, but he said, that's the culture we've inherited from our previous generations. That's the way we live. I grew up in the British equivalent of Detroit, but we didn't lock our doors. We didn't need to. Working class communities were communities. The police never came. They didn't need to come. We didn't want them. There was no divorce, no petty theft of that variety. Four doors up from us, there was a lady who was in bed with MS. Her husband got her up in the morning, went to work. The neighbours would drop in, so would the postman, the baker, everybody, and the money was in the teapot. Everybody knew it. No thug ever abused that reality. They wouldn't have survived if they tried. My mother had the family gift of the gab and was very much in demand as a speaker to women's groups. although she'd left school aged 12 or 13. And she would come back on the bus at night sometimes and walk for 10 minutes through semi-darkened streets to our house in the British equivalent of Detroit. Would any of you be willing to do that today? I mean, you'd be drunk if you were willing, and you wouldn't get home if you did. But not then. There were no attacks on women. It was a real community built on ideas that can all be traced back to the Bible. Mrs. Thatcher, lots of things she did I don't think too much of, but she was, when they called her Victorian, she said proudly so. Now, what was wrong with those Victorians, and should be the difference between us, is that they pretended they had the virtues which they proposed. That's their hypocrisy and inauthenticity. We should not make that mistake, but we should say that those are still virtues. They are real virtues. And to the extent that they were real, they changed things. Revival in the 18th century changed the nature of Britain. Revivals in the modern world do not change the nature of the world we live in, because we do not work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. I mean, in the 18th century, Britain was a mess. Drunk for a penny, dead drunk for two, clean straw for three was the standard advertising. And they meant it. Gin. It was a gin-sodden town, London. And when Whitfield and Wesley started to preach it, it changed in 6 weeks. It took a few years, but the Clapham sect and all that went with it, the abolition of slavery, the end of child labour, the reform of prisons, the beginning of proper trade unions when they were necessary, the end of the Corn Laws, these were all the result of the 18th century revival. America succeeded for the same reasons. You had no development programs, yet you succeeded. Now, the two greatest writers on this are de Tocqueville, who was a French aristocrat whose family had suffered at the French Revolution. He came to visit you in the late 18th century, in order to understand why your revolution had succeeded and the French one was a bloody mess. And he said he did not understand America until he went into the churches of America. And that is still true today, that churches are places where, even more so here than in Canada, when I go there and point out something could be done that would be a Christian witness, not as preaching the gospel in the rather reduced sense that we often use it, but as a demonstration of Christian character, they will do it. And if I suggest a book, you're likely to go and buy it and read it and then write to me and say, what do I read next? The Canadians say, oh, that's interesting, and they buy a beer and go and watch the hockey. We are too comfortable. We have this wonderful arrangement where another country pays the big bill of defence, and we're very happy about that. We should be a lot more charitable than we are. But that's the world that Mangal Wadi saw so clearly coming from his Indian background, and is what he wanted. And of course, being the bright man he is, here's the takeaway now to one of them. Does conversion make you good? Well, who's for yes? Who's for no? And who hasn't thought about it, eh? You're right, it's no, isn't it? Conversion makes you redeemed. You're under new ownership, but it's a very relaxed ownership, because it's a love story. He wants you to fall in love with him. And when you fall in love with someone, you start doing things for them that you wouldn't do without that love. That's what changes the world. And particularly in relation to family and children, and it works its way through. You should see generation by generation a building on that process. And when you meet it, it's very real. We have a friend who's currently nursing his wife through the terminal stages of Alzheimer's. Now, he's never progressed. He's a doctor beyond the head prefect at school. In a sense that he's innocent in wonderful ways, and he can trace, and his wife could trace, on both sides of his family, missionaries in every generation back to Hudson Taylor. That's quite a story. And it shows. Lewis captures it in Screwtape Letters, where he has Screwtape complaining, or is it Worm? To Wormwood. How could you allow him to get into that family? Even the dog smells of Christianity. And it's a kind of smelling of Christianity, being, you know, the family aroma in a good sense. That's where virtue comes from. And primarily the Jews will teach you it comes from men taking their duty to teach their children the stories of the Bible seriously. If you do that, there will be a reward. So Mangal Wadi went on from that experience, and he finishes it off even better. He says, shortly he was speaking at a conference, and he made the point that he'd said, if that was India, we'd take the milk and the money. And an Egyptian said, in Egypt, we'd take the milk, the money, and the cow. But it tells you cultures are different. And that man in Egypt, of course, is an nth generation Muslim. At that level, they know to a degree. At that level is where we should make progress. Few look at the biography of Mohammed and put the biography of Jesus alongside. They are so different. They are so different. Yes, Allah is all-powerful, but he never thought his power could be used on earth with his creatures, where he would go and sort out the devil in hell, so to speak. It's a different story, and it produces a different culture. The story you inhabit produces the culture you get. And when they thin out, they die. Toynbee studied cultures and how long they last. 22 of them during the whole of his life. He wrote about a sort of end-of-life book called An Historian Looks at Religion. And he said, when a culture is about to die, the patterns are consistent frequently. The first thing that happens in a culture that is in deep trouble is that you lose your moral consensus. You no longer believe about the nature of good and evil. You don't believe the same thing. Does anybody in our universities today inhabit a culture that has agreement about good and evil? No, it has gone. That's number one down. When that happens, you constantly go backwards and forwards depending upon power between assisting the law or going against the law. But it leads to a general loss of respect for law. Has that happened in America? Totally. And that's dangerous. Smart people like, Jordan Peterson, who's not a Christian, says it's a good idea to live as though there is a God. And people like, I always get which one it is, whether it's John Locke or Hobbes, but they said, you must obey them. No, it's Descartes, actually. Descartes said, I'm not particularly interested in conversion and things like that, but you should obey the church and obey the law, because stability is the essential requirement for anything else to be achieved. And that's true. As that goes, everything falls. Now, the next thing that happens, of course, is when you realize that you're no longer a law-abiding citizen, how do you feel about yourself? Not so good. That's why we have all these books on how to improve your self-image, which, of course, written by psychologists from a base that's not adequate, are totally useless. They're not built on a solid foundation. Not totally useless, but they're nowhere near what the problem needs. Now, when that happens, the next thing is you start wanting to shut your mind off. Most of you have had to deal with addicts, right? And they say, when you sober up, how do you feel? Terrible. So you get drunk again so you don't feel. That's the process. Very hard to get out of, as you well know. Then it moves on to promiscuity of two varieties. First of all, you begin to be able to hold logically inconsistent ideas simultaneously, because intellectual coherence breaks down. immediately. I mean, I've had this response when saying to someone, getting them to say, which it's not difficult to do, that all truth, what's this? That's the way they normally put it, all truth is relative, to which I respond, including that statement. And they say, I don't accept your logic. And I've even had a feminist say, I don't accept your phallocentric logic. That was an interesting thought. I actually held my tongue for once, and to this day I regret it, because I was tempted to say, madam, if I think with that organ, it puts you at something of a disadvantage. But I didn't say that. But it certainly came into my mind. That, and then, of course, sexual promiscuity, which you deal with all the while. You know, the, was it million STIs a day in the world is the WHO's current estimate. It's not such a big number when you put it one per, I mean, but you'll never be unemployed if you're looking after sexually transmitted disease. It's not going to go away, and all its complications. That's the world that we need to be able to describe, because that has to be the starting point. That is the reality with which we must live. So if what you're proposing doesn't deal with that, big problem. And of course, that's not what we're doing in medicine, is it? We started ethics courses in medical school not so very long ago. I mean, 1970s, something like that. 70s, maybe even 80s in most places. 80s, yeah. Our one started in the 1980s. There was no ethics course when I went to medical school. If anybody had asked us, do you trust everybody in your class to make a decent doctor, do a good job? Yeah. It's a question we wouldn't have thought about. I mean, we were sinners, just like everybody else was, but we lived within a framework where we knew what our duties were, and we accepted them. You see, before the Enlightenment, common sense, peasant-like, if you like, view of the world was the basis for ethics. That's what the world thought. If everybody saw it that way, then it would work that way. You had to be very clever to do the things that the Enlightenment sophisticates did and destroyed us in the process. Different world. When we started teaching our ethics course in Ottawa, I, of course, was not involved. But I met the dean at a cocktail party shortly after he started our ethics program. And he was a nice man. I liked him. He was a palliative care physician. So I couldn't resist teasing him. And I said, I see you're starting an ethics program. That's a lovely idea. Do you think it will make ethical doctors? And he said, well, that's the objective of the exercise, isn't it? Yeah, I said, but will it do it? He said, I hope so. Well, I said, I can tell you it won't. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm probably the only guy in your faculty who actually has lunch with some philosophers every week. And the guy you've chosen to coordinate this course illustrates my point beautifully. He's technically a competent ethicist. He can tell you all the various ways of thinking about it and do it well. He's also an honest man. He says, I only teach ethics, I don't practice them. And you all know people in your church who couldn't define what ethics are, but they are ethical. And there are people who could define what ethics are, and they are not ethical. The problem is not a problem of knowledge. It's a problem of the will. And that's an entirely different sort of problem. The good that I would, I cannot do it. The will that the good that I would, I cannot do it. The evil that I would not, that I do. Who shall deliver me? Romans 7. You need to major in being able to get Romans 7 into conversations frequently these days. Not direct quotes, for goodness sake, don't give chapter and verse. You can quote the Bible in the university now as long as you don't say it's the Bible and you refuse to tell them who wrote it. Then they have to take it at face value. They will track it down. It's important to paraphrase because then they can't use Google on the spot. So when you've worked out your paraphrase of Romans 7, try it out on Google fairly regularly to see whether Google can find it yet. And when it does, change. You've got to be able to say it in a way that forces them out of their comfort zone and to look at it straight on. You all have colleagues who claim to be Christian, you don't trust them. Right? because they are redeemed and not good. And you have other colleagues who are utterly trustworthy and claim not to be Christian. There, the way to open that one up is to get a family biography and squeeze it out of them. You won't go back more than a generation or two before you find a missionary, a pastor, a rabbi, whatever. Virtue, behavior, is very much part of the family. That's Deuteronomy, isn't it? If you will keep this law, what happens? It will go well with you and your children. He says forever, as long as you go on keeping it. The experience of Mount Sinai made it impossible to disbelieve in God, but it did not make them good. What made them good was the enculturation of the Torah. And that's the reason to this day that Jews, despite their horrendous persecution over the centuries, win sometimes 50% of the real Nobel Prizes every year. I don't mean the silly ones like peace, I mean the real ones. The ones that have content to them. The real sciences. Mathematics is the field prize, they win that too. Why? They'll tell you, it's Deuteronomy 6. Enculturating in your children from the moment they are born, the stories, in their case, of the Old Testament. And the point about Jewish history is that it's morally consequential. No other history in the world is. Does anybody get away with anything in Jewish history? No. I mean, sometimes God does look as though he holds families and nations responsible. It can take a little while for the hammer to fall, but it does fall. And so Jewish kids come into the world with a realistic view of human nature, which makes them good at business, and a realization that character matters because it's consequential. Now, the most interesting, if any of you have got business people in your family, here's a book you can give to them. It's Robert Fogel's book, The Fourth Great Awakening. Robert Fogel's Jewish Nobel Prize winner in economics, teaching in the world's most famous department of economics. He died a couple of years ago. And about 10 years ago, I met him, because it doesn't need to go into those details, and we had a lovely conversation because I wanted to know what made him write this book. And he wrote it for his wife, who had died just before he wrote the book, and because of the students in his class. I'm going to get to it in just a second. The title of the book is The Fourth Great Awakening. His name is Robert Fogel, F-O-G-E-L, and if I remember right, it is University of Chicago Press. But you only need Fogel, Fourth Great Awakening. The other thing that provoked him to write it was looking at his class in the world's most famous department of economics. And he said to himself, I don't trust these guys to run the economy, but in 10 years' time they will be. 2008, it all fell apart. And it was an ethical failure on both the side that should have been applying the rules and the people doing the banking. He saw it coming. And in the middle of the book, what he did next is he said, he started being Jewish, he did it historically. He asked the question, why did America succeed? I mean, it is an amazing story. In the early 1700s, you were not ahead of Europe in any category. It was a very close-run thing. If John Adams hadn't been the man that he was, you wouldn't be here today as Americans. And he doesn't get anywhere near the credit, in my view. He and Washington are the ones that matter. I mean, Jefferson, I mean, leave him in left field where he belongs. But Adams, amazing story. And I already pointed out what de Tocqueville said about you. You have the knowledge, the character of a church. Chesterton, coming 100 years later, put it as only Chesterton would. I mean, he would come even more to the point. He didn't say that I didn't understand till I went into the church. He said simply, America has the character of a church. Which it did. Because you did go to church. You were very church-going. You still are the most church-going country in the Western world. But it's declining very rapidly. And the depth of that church-going is a bigger problem still. Now, I've already been going on far too long, and I've got halfway through a third of the way through what I intended to do in the first issue. Is there coffee at the back?
Yes.
So we could take a break, and those who've had enough can quietly slide out and not feel embarrassed.
We've got get about 20 minutes before lunch.
20 minutes before lunch?
20.
Oh, my goodness. I have no idea.
We've heard a good biography.
What?
We've heard a good biography. Your biography.
Oh, yeah.
You did get that.
Yeah. Well, yes. Well, the coffee's probably... Get a coffee if you want one. If you want a coffee... I think I'd like one, and then I'll go on to another 15 minutes at least. Yeah. I need a coffee. Oh, yes, I'm hooked up. Chew, yeah. Yeah, could someone get me a coffee, just a little milk, and then I can stay connected to my chains. Okay. Now, to pick up, what happened in the Christian era is worth thinking about quite a lot. Rodney Stark has done a very nice book on the early growth of Christianity, which was far faster than anyone would have predicted, but quite explicable. It's not an impossible rate, so to speak. Why did it happen, and what were the changes? Well, the world really did change after Christ was here. The resurrection was the beginning of a new world order, and it showed up in things that had never happened before. And two of them are particularly intriguing to me. The first one is the attitude to children. Throughout human history, wherever you archaeologists go, they expect to find the bones of children who died young for no obvious reason, and sometimes who were obviously killed. People have always thought that they couldn't handle another baby. And of course, as a Christian, can you say that? I don't think you can, not without being heretical at one sense. And one of my favorite examples of how the world changed is a letter written by a Roman administrator to Rome asking for help. And the letter said this: these Christians, and they were persecuting Christians in various ways by this time, rivers of blood flowed, but these Christians are not exposing their own children. That was the standard way. There were, in many Levantine cities, there were places to dump a child you didn't want. If somebody wanted to pick it up, they could. Otherwise, it died and the dogs ate it and nobody cared. But the Christians, before there was any organized church to any great degree, Paul was writing his letters still, or when they were still being circulated, they started not doing that. Now, the next bit is artistic license on my part, but I imagine it went something like this, that early Christians wanted to meet together, as Christians always do, and they had to do it when they could. It wouldn't be easy. But it would be a high point of their lives, and afterwards they'd want to talk and probably find something to eat and drink together if they could, as we always have. Then one Sunday, or one such meeting, I imagine them looking around, and one couple are a bit quiet. And they say, "You're quiet this week. Is there anything wrong?" Well, they say, we're pregnant, and we don't think we can handle another baby, but it is a gift from God. What do we do? Now, what's any good church going to say at that point? We will help. And that's what they did. And of course, they discovered, as all churches do, if you don't have babies, you're a dying church, and it won't be long before it's all over. But if you have babies there, not only are you a growing church, you'll be growing spiritually as well. Particularly on this side of the continent, much better than in England, certainly, and better in the US than Canada, although Canada does it too. When somebody has a new baby, the church tends to see that there's a few meals in the freezer and things like that. Outreach. And if a single mum arrives in your church, she ought to be welcomed and she won't have to buy baby clothes, right? That's how it happened. And then these early folk found that, well, babies are good for us. They make us better people. And then I hope this is right, but I imagine that someone picked up a child like that. And when the child got to about 10 or 11, when old enough to understand, they sat her down, because it would likely be a girl, and they said, "You are our daughter, and we love you dearly, but God brought you into our family in a very special way. We were walking through the gates of the city, and someone had left you in the dirt by the gate, And the love of Jesus so flowed through us that we had to pick you up. And we're so glad we did. You don't have to preach the gospel to that girl, do you? It's done. This is pure St. Francis. Preach the gospel, if necessary, use words. And the much maligned Dark Ages did that in many ways. Things started to get better at the grassroots level. The monasteries were the central feature that survived, where they were the only books, and they fell for rapaciousness many times. They had their problems. But they did hold up the light in various ways, and Christianity allows inventiveness to go. The authorities are not opposed to it, like the imams are, for instance. They don't. Certain things, they just don't do that. And that's why they don't make anything. You don't buy anything from Muslim countries except carpets, because their loyalty doesn't go beyond the family. I mean, oil is not theirs. We discovered it, we dug it up, we process it, and they take the money. That's hardly work. In fact, it's destroying them. So the attitude towards children, and then the first hospitals began. People went looking for people who needed help. The monasteries grew in that way. So shortly after Benedict, within a few centuries, there were thousands of monasteries across Europe. There were places where people could go, and they did what they could. Many people get better just with love and attention, don't they? As Florence Nightingale discovered, you simply get people clean and given water, and figures improve immediately. So not much more than love is required at that stage to get some process. But the world was changing. Educationally, it was changing. The book to read here that's a lovely read is Hannam's book, How the Middle Ages Made Science Possible. It's a really beautiful book. And it will give you a history of the Middle Ages in terms of the characters who made major differences, who were Christian. And it's a lot of them. In fact, it was Christendom. There was no other story in town. Because throughout this period, a combination of the Old Testament and Aristotle was in practice the way people thought about things. The idea of explanation in the modern world is quite different. And that's something we need to go that far back. When we explain what our sexual drives are about in the modern world, we end up with a mess we've got. But explanation in the ancient world was richer than that. To explain something, you needed, first of all, to know what it was made out of. The material, of course. You needed to know what ideas went into it. Where did it come from as a concept? That's the formal course. Now, material we can deal with in the modern world, but we're not very good at ideas. You can't measure them. And yet we want a world in which everything can be measured. The efficient cause, how it's made, the techniques, that we can do something about in the modern world. But the final one is the one that mattered most. Why was it made? What is the purpose of this thing? Genesis 1 has got purpose built into it all the way through, the sequence. It's all teleological. When we moved from that world to the scientific world, we didn't realize what was going to happen. Now, this began, as I said, in the late 13th century. Thomas Aquinas had been the person who, once Aristotle came back into the West, synthesized it with the scriptures to a considerable degree, and he was a very devout Christian, a man who began his day and spent much time in the day praying. Whenever he got stopped in his prayer, next to his desk he had a kneeling desk, and he then prayed till the Lord gave him how to move on. I love his prayer, which says, ask God to be present in the conception and present in the execution and to give the power to bring it to completion. He wanted God in all three phases. Some people in the church, the Bishop of Paris in particular, were worried about what this new synthesis was going to do. The universities began in the 12th century or thereabouts. It's all Catholic. And so the Bishop of Paris banned the teaching of Aquinas until it had been considered as to whether this would actually in the long run lead to the growth of the faith or be counteractive to the faith. That committee never actually reported. But it did mean that for a little while, the University of Paris, one of the earliest universities, the professors were not allowed to do deductive logic. Oxford continued with it. That's where induction began. Now, the reason they teach your children at university that it's the hypothetico-deductive system, which it isn't, because they don't want to face the implications of induction. It was inductive. Now, what are the implications of induction? How many of you have been to Africa? Only one or two, so it doesn't work very well. Africa is a place where induction doesn't work, for good reason. They couldn't do deduction, so they started doing induction. And I think the argument went like this, although it's not written anywhere that I'm aware of, that deduction started with the idea of God and worked all the way down to the particulars of how to make an internal combustion engine, if you like. And, of course, you never make that journey. It's intellectually you get lost on the way every time somewhere. And so that they were brilliant at logic. The Middle Ages is much more logical than we are. And they would pick up a logical error instantly, which no modern student would. But they didn't achieve very much. So imagine that after the teaching of deductive logic was banned, they sort of met together in the pub and got drunk, first of all, because next year did not look happy. You couldn't use your notes from last year. And then when they sobered up, they said, well, what are we going to do? And I think the conversation would go like this. We were supposed as Christians to have control over nature in order to steward it, but we have precious little control over nature. There's not much to show since Christ came 1,000 years or more ago. Maybe we're doing it wrong. But if God is who we think he is, we could work the other way around. But if you don't believe this, you can't even have this thought. I wrote a paper once, and I've forgotten where it went, but it was called Why, if Newton had not had his laws, he would not have gone looking. If Newton had not had his God, he would not have gone looking for his laws. You need to believe that under the surface chaos of life, there's order. Without that, you wouldn't do an experiment. I mean, if you explain, as most of Africa still does, if you explain disease as the action of evil spirits who are local, it explains why that family loses a child and that one doesn't. Evil spirits make perfect sense of that. But that's not very helpful. You're not going to get very far. But if that isn't the reason the child died, it's not an evil spirit, and that God is ultimately in charge, then yes, we have a problem of pain and suffering, but we have some answers to that too. But there must be order under the surface chaos because God is a God of order. And of course there was. Now, it took time. 1277 is when Aquinas was banned. The next century was when Merton College actually drew the first graph without knowing what they'd done. But they were doing experiments, heating up a rod and measuring how long it took from the heat at this end to get back to the cool end. And then they drew a graph. Distance over temperature. Aristotle never got to the ratio, which we call velocity. He is one of the smartest men who ever lived. Once you see it, of course we use it all the while, but it's a ratio. It comes out of a graph very easily. No graphs, it doesn't come so easily. So the world changed as a result. And then Occam made a big change, which affects all of you, a key move in the Western world, which has had disastrous as well as positive results. He was a smart man who understood that what was happening in Oxford, he was there too, was risky to the Christian faith, nevertheless, because he could see it was going to succeed. And that might marginalize theology. So what he did was pull apart the things that can be measured and appreciated with our senses from the things that cannot be measured, the immaterial things. Now, we've reached a stage now where I can say to any university audience on this continent, I can get them in less than 2 minutes to recognize that their problem lies in the immaterial world, not the material one. And all I have to say to them is, I've only been in your university a few hours, but I know you all hate divorce. And immediately you see the body language tighten up, because that's very unkind and politically incorrect, isn't it? But I say, I can see you do hate it. And I can tell you why. If it hasn't happened to you, it has happened to your friends. Has any child ever enjoyed it? The answer is no, isn't it? I mean, if it's sad enough that in your life you do end up with a divorce, the one thing you shouldn't say to your children is, it will be all right. The only thing you should say to them, I'm so sorry this has happened. They still love you, they will forgive you. But don't tell them they're not in pain. They are. And the honesty is the only way out. That's the immaterial world. We cannot live without truth, justice, fidelity, love, honour. It's impossible. We can live without all sorts of things that you currently think you couldn't live without, but you would, you'd get by. If the world fell apart, we'd head for an African village. It wouldn't make any difference to them. They've got nothing now, but they survive. That loss of teleology, with the success of the scientific revolution, that went from Occam to Descartes to Bacon, who said, collect facts, and he changed the meaning of the word fact. Before Bacon, moral facts were more important than physical facts. When he said collect facts, he meant physical facts, as you do when you use the word fact now. But moral facts are actually more important than physical facts, and we don't make the distinction anymore. But our children are suffering because of it. Within 100 years of that move, Laplace says to Napoleon, I don't need the concept of God to do science, and you've got the secular world right there, a world that does not need God to function. But it cannot escape the reality that it needs the immaterial world to function. It was being parasitic on a world it refused to acknowledge. Because why, if you're an assistant professor and your research has not been going well and you suddenly realize, I could fabricate some data to produce what I think is going to happen and get it published, and I'll get tenure. Same applies to master's students and the like. And they're doing it. We have no idea how much of the literature is now fabricated, because it takes 10 years to find out. If you're very clever, you do papers that are good enough to be published and not important enough to be repeated. Then you get promoted. You get it wrong and draw a conclusion that has implications, and you lose your job. But you'll have earned 100,000, several hundred, 100,000 a year before they throw you out. Why would you not do that if you're a Darwinian? The Darwinian world is a non-teleological world without moral consequence. That's why it's failing. And I have to leave it there. But do remember that the reductionism, which is how science began, inductive reasoning is getting rid of anything in the model that isn't essential. Like Galileo knew he was not taking notice of friction. He knew what it was. So he polished like mad to make the Planck smooth so that he could let the ball roll down and neglect friction. And that's what we do in science. We reduce in order to understand. And it works in science. It gives us workable laws. You can't do that in the moral world. It doesn't work that way. But we became reductionists. You, within months of getting to medical school, started to see patients as medical, biophysical problems. You didn't even think about it. All of you have been guilty of talking about the gallbladder in the third bed or some equivalent, right? That's what happens to us. And that's what we have to think about, how we're going to change. Because the problems we're looking at now for the rest of this week are largely behavioural, aren't they? The problems in your practice are largely due to behaviour in one way or another. And there's no physical science to that that will answer the questions. This is where a cultural story comes in, and I'll start this evening with cultural story and move on as the first example to the current silly episode, the transgender chapter in the cultural story, which can't last for long.